Where do you see your career in 10 years? What are you doing now to help you get there? The sooner you start enhancing your skills, the sooner you'll be ready. That's why AARP has reskilling courses in a variety of categories like marketing and management to help your income live as long as you do.
That's right. AARP has a bevy of free skill building courses for you to choose from because the steps that you choose to take today will help you to love what you do in the future. And that's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking overcoming your scarcity brain with Michael Easter.
Yeah, that's right. We are joined by Michael Easter. So he's the author of Scarcity Brain, and we are pumped to have him on the podcast today. And so we're talking about scarcity, right? And even though we know what the word means, scarcity is likely a concept that few folks listening to this podcast have much experience with. At the very least, in our quite developed country, we have enough food, we have enough shelter and clothing on hand that the vast majority of folks haven't felt the true impacts of real scarcity. And in fact, most of us have more than we need of all of those things, plus the countless cardboard boxes of stuff that we can also purchase to fill in any remaining containers and closets that aren't already bursting at the seams. But we are talking with Michael, and he has traveled the world. He's observed tribes in the jungles of Bolivia. He's studied addiction in bombed out hotels in Baghdad. He's spoken with the top researchers of psychology in order to understand the human mind. And we're going to be talking about how it is that we can shake some bad habits in order to live more fulfilling lives. And hopefully we'll have some great takeaways on how it is that we can view and pursue money in a more satisfying way as well. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This should be fun.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it, Michael. The first question we ask anybody who comes on the show is, and it reveals a little bit about them, but like Matt and I, we like to save and invest money for the future, but we also like to spend money in the here and now on things that matter to us. Craft beer is one of those. And so we always like to ask our guests, what's their craft beer equivalent? What are they spending money on intentionally, maybe more so than most people would think is wise, while they're doing the right thing with their money too?
Yeah, I would say my most obscene purchase is probably a nice watch. Now, I will say it's because, one, I just like well-made watches, I'm kind of a watch dork. But two, I also rationalize it as a business expense because in some of the places I travel for my work, having a nice bargaining chip, if you find yourself in a pickle, is a good thing. And certain brands, it's like, I mean, that'll get you out of a pickle pretty quick if you're like, hey, I'll trade you my watch for XYZ. So that's how I rationalize it.
Okay. That's so funny. Matt just stumbled upon at a bar recently a watch club. And I swear.
A local restaurant. So it's called Red Bar. Do you have one of those clubs over there?
No. Well, maybe. I don't know. Not that I know of.
Okay. But if Matt's going to get into any hobby, I'm predicting it's going to be fancy watches. So.
I would tell you to avoid it. You'll save a lot of money.
I do feel like I am resisting. Like Joel talked me into getting this Garmin, which actually maybe we'll talk about this later on as far as technology and gamification, but they were on sale at Costco, and I have been pretty happy with not only the time it keeps, but also some of the health data, the stats that it feeds me.
It's amazing how much it gives you for $150.
I'll say that. I'm trying to avoid the chronographs, actual fancy watches. But Michael, I feel like now is as good a time as ever to talk about habits here towards the beginning of the year. But you say that, this is a quote, it doesn't matter how much gas that we give our good new habits. If we don't resolve our bad ones, we still have our foot on the brake. Talk to us about what you mean by that and why you're kind of obsessed with individual human behavior that's actually in our own worst interest.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's rather simple. It's that we kind of live in this world where there's all this information about all these things we should do. I mean, I'm kind of more in the health, wellness, psychology space. And, you know, you see, it's like adopt this new specific exercise routine, add this food to your thing. We're always trying to add the next new good habit. But when you look at what actually moves the ball farthest downfield for people in terms of improving their life, improving their well-being, I would imagine the exact same thing follows for finances. It's to stop doing the stuff that hurts you most.
Yeah.
So it's to cut out the foods that are your triggers and are leading you to gain weight. It's to stop making that purchase that is putting a massive dent in your finances. Usually, all things equal, taking away bad habits is going to move the ball a lot farther downfield than is adding good new shiny habits. Because if you are giving gas to those good new habits, but you still have your bad ones, it's like you just got the car in with the emergency brake on.
Yeah, yeah. And you're just like revving the engine. You're not going anywhere. Yep. You're doing a lot of damage at the same time. Give me like the elevator pitch for your book, Scarcity Brain. Like, what is it that you were trying to accomplish with this one? Because I was telling you before we started recording, I read your book, The Comfort Crisis, before I read this one. Talk to me about Scarcity Brain and what caused you to write it.
Yeah, I mean, so the underlying question of that book is, you know, everyone knows that everything is fine in moderation, and yet everyone sucks at moderation. And so why is that, right? And what is it that we can't seem to moderate? And when you look at it, the behaviors that people have trouble with is they usually fall into a handful of silos, like eating too much food, buying too much stuff, information binges online, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these are all behaviors that in the past would have helped us survive. So a lot of my work, it takes an evolutionary lens on our modern problems. So if you think about all the things we crave today, usually in the past they were scarce, they were hard to find. And if you would have sort of overdone them, that would have given you a survival advantage. But in today's world where we have an overload of information, where we have an overload of food, where we have Amazon Prime and a billion items that we could buy and get in 24 hours, all at our fingertips, that is not always so good for us. So we tend to overdo these things in a world where it ultimately backfires. Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about scarcity cues, Michael, because you say that they can be big, but they can also be small and subtle, and, you know, even down to our neighbors, like buying a new car. You know, is that keeping up with the Joneses like a cue in this case? You know, just the felt need to not lag behind others, our neighbors, our friends, even if it ends up meaning that we end up going down the path of falling into consumer debt. Talk to us a little bit about scarcity cues.
Yeah, so a scarcity cue is a piece of information in our environment that we encounter in our environment that makes us feel as if the resources that we need to sort of thrive and survive are scarce. So I'll give the example of, you know, neighbor buys a fancy new car. What tends to happen is that this is a sort of threat to our status almost. So the mm-hmm. scarcity cue is that we don't have enough status, because now people buy cars, yes, to get from point A to point B, but also because cars have become a sort of status symbol. And it can be something as simple as that. A good big example that I think everyone can identify with would be the pandemic. So when the pandemic first set in, you know, all of a sudden everyone goes, oh, I'm not going to have enough food, I'm not going to have enough toilet paper, I'm not going to have enough XYZ, right? This big scarcity cue. So what does everyone do? They go to the grocery stores, they brawl in the aisle, they buy all kinds of food that they're never going to eat, right? It's like, oh, we got to have 100 tins of Spam. Definitely throw that in the car.
That 25-pound bag of rice from Costco came in clutch, Michael.
I believe it. But they don't have to be that big either. I mean, there's this there's really interesting research from Vanderbilt that found that even when people have a scarcity cue, like running out of ink and a pen, something as simple as that, they will make decisions that sort of show hoarding behavior. So they'll be like, okay, I need multiple pens. And like, they start kind of freaking out inside. And so, I think that you see this, this is basically an evolutionary survival thing we have, right? In the past, if you had this cue that like, oh, maybe I'm not going to have enough food to survive. Oh no, it would totally make sense to go out and try and hoard as much food as possible. But today it's like food is never really that scarce, right, exactly, anymore, right? I mean, we throw out about a third of the food that we produce in this country. And so, and this obviously applies to a lot of different areas in our lives. And I think it ultimately leads people to make decisions that don't exactly make sense in the context of today.
So how do we connect our brains to kind of the scarcity cue, maybe, that's tapping into some sort of primal urge that might cause us to do something that's not in our best interest? Because times have changed, and guess what? Like, I don't necessarily need to go buy a 12-pack of pens just because I ran out of ink in the one. And actually, I probably have three more in the drawer somewhere that I just haven't looked for yet. Is there a way to kind of overcome that scarcity cue that kind of gets brought to your attention, but it's almost like subconscious?
Yeah, I think we need useful heuristics. So I'll give you an example with possessions. So there are effectively four reasons why people buy stuff. The first is because stuff is a tool, right? You use tools to accomplish something. That's how things have pretty much always been. But you can also buy stuff, like I mentioned before, for status. You buy it because it elevates you over someone else in the social hierarchy. The third reason is because possessions can help us feel belonging. So for example, you buy a Utah Jazz jersey because you're a Utah Jazz fan and you want to identify with other Jazz fans, right? It's part of this like collective thing. And then fourth is boredom. So you see that when people get bored, we go looking for escapes from it. And today we usually go on our phones, and what we look at on our phones, I mean, we're seeing advertisement after advertisement, and it's never been easier before to click that ad, click through to the buy button, and then buy this thing that you go, wait, did I really need that? So in the context of this, I think you need to, when you're sort of feeling like you want to, say, make a purchase, you need to ask yourself, what am I buying this for? Is it for status? Is it because I want to feel some sort of belonging? Can I get that elsewhere? Or am I just bored? So I run things through the heuristic of gear, not stuff. So gear is possessions that we use to achieve a higher purpose, right? We're using them to accomplish some bigger thing that gives us deeper meaning. Whereas everything else, stuff, is sort of like, yeah, I'm going to buy this brand because I want to look cooler than my neighbor. Or I want to do this because I want to feel some belonging with this random, you know, corporation, whatever it might be. Or I'm just bored. And so I think trying to figure out, get to the root of why you're doing what you do is the key to starting to unpack larger behavior changes.
So as you kind of run a purchase through that set of criteria, are some of those, do you think, inherently better than the others? Obviously, like when you say something is a tool, it sounds cool, or, you know, like it sounds like justified. It sounds noble. You're like, oh no, I'm using this to accomplish something. Whereas obviously boredom that sounds like a terrible reason. But I feel like the two in the middle, right? Status and belonging. I feel like those are a little squishier. I feel like in my mind, those are a little more gray. And would you push back against anybody who would be critical of somebody for buying something in order to fit in with a group, you know, for that belonging, or even to signal to others that maybe they're better, right? Like that's basically that conspicuous consumption that you're talking about.
Or that's
there.
What luxury goods are, right? Almost to
yeah,
a tea.
Totally. So I think that my, I'm definitely not here to pass any value judgments. I would rather just people be aware of why.
Okay.
So, you know, I always like to say, you know, for example, let's take behaviors of using your phone too much. It's like, I don't care if someone wants to spend 9 hours a day on Instagram. I really don't care. But what I want people to be able to do is make the conscious decision about them doing that. Because often today we do things without really understanding what the underlying motivation is. So if you want to buy that, you know, whatever it is, I'll take myself that certain watch brand.
Yeah.
Because it's also a status symbol. It's like, all right, but I just want you to know, I just want a person to be aware of, okay, this is one of the reasons I'm buying it. Because I think we try to make these rationalizations in our mind where we go, oh no, like this is blah, 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 blah. And we talk ourselves into purchases that maybe we otherwise wouldn't have made if we were being honest with ourselves.
Yeah, it's funny. It makes me think about how Matt always talks about using text messages. I have some friends who communicate solely via text message. And like, I haven't actually talked to them or had a conversation or met with them in real life in quite a while. And Matt, the way he talks about it is like, no, it's always to facilitate in-person hangs. And so if you're going to text me, let's come up with a plan to actually make the real life hike or beer hang actually, you know, actually happen. Is that maybe a good way to think about it? Using these digital platforms, using shot, and it makes me think about buying a shirt for a bowling league is like one sort of consumption that helps you fit in versus buying that Utah Jazz jersey that you mentioned and having like the three different versions, but watching alone on your TV at home, but you kind of sort of feel like you fit in, but you don't really fit in. I don't know. I know that there's
like one leads to like a more ultimate community.
Yeah.
Versus one that feels a little more virtual and like a little more artificial.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think so. And I think if it's facilitating actual interaction between people, that's great. And maybe it is online. That's totally fine. But I do think that you see this a lot. You see, I think where it gets a little weird is when you see corporations sort of use this as a means to get people to buy. So a lot of times today, you know, certain brands have become almost a sort of religion where people buy into them because they symbolize some other social thing that they're trying to claim, yet they're not actually doing anything social behind that purchase.
That's right. Okay, so I guess while we're kind of talking about buying stuff on the shopping front, like there's research saying that like when a website, when it's got one of those like stupid discount wheels that you spin, like that folks end up spending more money. There are just some of these different types of ways that we're incentivized to be parted with our dollars. How have you seen that play out in some of the research that you've looked at?
Yeah, so I live in Vegas and I got really interested in slot machines because this is sort of the extreme end of people who just can't seem to get enough. Right. So Las Vegas, there are slot machines everywhere and people play them around the clock. Like I can go fill up my, you know, car with gas and go into pay and there's slot machines in the gas station. There's people playing them around the clock. And you're just like, this doesn't make any sense. So long story short is that I start this, you know, deep dive investigation into slot machines. And I end up at this laboratory that is on the edge of town in Las Vegas, but it is a sort of casino laboratory hybrid. So it's this fully working brand new casino, but it is funded by not only the gambling industry, but also big tech. And it's used to figure out what gets humans to gamble more, to buy more, to do all these different behaviors. And while I'm there, I end up talking to this guy who's a slot machine designer. And he tells me about this thing that I call the scarcity loop. And it's basically this three-part behavior loop that is really good at pushing people out of moderation. So it's got three parts. It's got opportunity, it's got unpredictable rewards, and it's got quick repeatability. So one, you have an opportunity to get something of value that'll improve your life. Two, unpredictable rewards. You know when you will get that, you know you'll get that thing of value at some point, but you aren't entirely sure when and you don't know how valuable it's going to be. And then three, quick repeatability. You can immediately repeat the behavior to try and get the rewarding thing over and over and over. So if you think of a slot machine, it's like you can win some money. You play a game. You're not sure on any given game if you're going to lose, if you're going to win a little, or if you're going to win a lot. But then you can repeat that game over and over and over and over. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why this is important is because this exact same architecture that's in the slot machine is also being put into all sorts of different products and services and media stuff today. So it's really what makes social media work. Mm. It's being put into some personal finance apps. It's what makes dating apps work so well. There's just elements of it all over our lives right now. And giving people those unpredictable rewards, to bring it back to your question. So when you put a wheel in front of someone with a discount, and they spin that wheel, there's this moment of suspense where they're not sure if they're going to get the big discount, the little discount, or what. And when that lands, that's exciting. And that tends to compel behavior. So you see a six...
Even if it's just 10% off, you know?
Even if it's 10% off. And you see a six-fold increase in conversion rates when companies put the gambling wheel on their websites to sell something.
Yeah. What's interesting, too, is like you spend a lot of time in your book talking about like dopamine and how oftentimes that is confused with like, oh, dopamine, it's the feel-good chemical. But you clarify, and I feel like more research has been coming out recently that's talking about how, no, dopamine is the anticipation drug. Like, yeah. It's the chemical that's released as we are pursuing something or as we are anticipating something. And oftentimes, it's almost like the chase, or, you know, being better than the reward, perhaps, that oftentimes we're so addicted to. Is that what we're seeing?
Yeah. So there's different systems of the brain. Basically, there's the liking system, which is a system that is different than dopamine, but that is what actually gives you the pleasure. And then there's the wanting system. And this is what dopamine is involved in. So dopamine basically just helps you pursue the pleasurable thing. And it's also somewhat complicated because dopamine is involved in all these different processes in the body. So things can get kind of oversimplified to just like dopamine made me do it. It's like, not really. It was just kind of there, you know?
Yeah. So you mentioned the scarcity loop and you talked about gambling. And you mentioned how all these other sorts of things in our society are built kind of based on some of these same wiring to try to get us to do things that might not be in our own best interest. And makes me think of like an app like Robinhood, which is great democratization of investing for all, except for this potentially fatal flaw that causes people to invest their money or gamble their money thinking they're investing. And it also makes me think of sports gambling. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, it certainly seems like the rise of sports gambling, and there's one thing about going and playing at a machine, even at a gas station near where you live or something like that. There's something very different about that than having it in the palm of your hands, like hyper-optimized and targeted to try to get people to gamble away as much of their money as they possibly can.
Yeah, so I think what we're talking about here really is the quick repeatability angle.
100%.
So to your point, so that's the third part of the loop. Mm-hmm. So with the slot machines, it's like the slot machine is always going to stay in the casino. You have to physically go to the casino in order to play the slot machine. But with sports betting apps, you can do that anytime for whatever reason you want, right? And another thing that I think is really interesting with sports betting apps is they've further increased the quick repeatability by allowing people to make in-game bets. So through the casino industry's eyes, one of the issues with sports betting is that you make a bet and then there's this time delay until the game is over, right? So a person could make one bet, but then there's 3 hours till they might make the next bet based on whether or not they won or lost their bet on the previous game. So in order to shorten that interval, because speed is exceedingly important to the casino industry, a lot of the companies started allowing people to make bets on, hey, will the team score on this play? Are they going to score a touchdown? Is the next basket going to be a three-pointer? All these different things that happen throughout the game so people can make these really quick bets over and over and over as the game evolves.
That's right. Yeah. And again, sort of like you were saying earlier, this isn't necessarily to say that, hey, all sports betting is bad. But like you said, to be aware as to what it is that's going on behind the scenes and how, I mean, I feel like at the core of what you're writing about here with your book is that these companies are they're looking for ways to make money, whether it's through selling product, getting you to gamble, whatever it is. And as you found, they are using how it is that our brains are wired against us to cause us to continue to do that thing, whatever it is,
yeah,
that they're wanting you to do. But Michael, we've got more to get to with you. We've got plenty more questions. We'll get to all that right after this.
Cachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Cachava really earns their 52,000-plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Cachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Cachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Cachava. Just go to Cachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com/howtomoney.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. All right, we're back. We're still talking about overcoming our scarcity brain with Michael Easter. His new book is just fantastic. If you want a little or a lot of insight on how your own brain works, and then how you can fight back against some of the ways that advertisers and companies and technology companies in particular are trying to hijack that, this book is incredibly informative. Michael, I want to keep talking about like some of the problem that and some of the ways in which companies are ever so insidiously impacting our ability, our desire to spend, to part us from our money maybe that we hadn't planned on being parted from. You've talked about some of the newer Chinese websites. There's one called Temu. And it's funny, Matt and I haven't talked about these sites a whole lot except for to say that some of the stuff that it seems like there's cheaper stuff being sold on a lot of these sites. But you call them the crystal meth of shopping. And so I'm like, okay, cool. I feel like I need to do a little more digging. What makes them so addictive? What makes them so dangerous?
Yeah. They use the scarcity loop probably better than any other sites. So it is the unpredictable reward. So when you log on to Temu, unless they've changed their site for some reason, there's immediately you get that pop-up, like I just talked about, with the wheel, right? And you spin the wheel and you learn you get some discount. And so then it's like, oh, I've just learned that I'm the winner, right? And that's it. You always get the big one on Temu. Like there's no actual gamble here. So then you're incentivized to purchase. But then they have all these, they use scarcity cues really well. So it's like, we only have X number of these items left. And then there's a timer going. So this leverages scarcity and urgency, which are two of the best sales tools that you can use, right? We only have one. And by the way, you got to make a decision in the next 5 minutes. That'll get someone to make a purchase better than anything you can really use. But even Amazon uses this. So when you go on to Amazon, if there's a short supply, it'll say, oh, only three left or only five mm-hmm. left, right? Because that leads people, it makes people more likely to click that buy button. I mean, there's a good, Amazon doesn't do anything on accident. They're not just being like, hey, heads up. They know that that'll lead to people making purchases.
There's probably another pallet being shipped to an Amazon warehouse as that exists on the website. But still, they want you to want it to make you feel like you got to buy it now.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with all these levers that get pulled, and you know, they get pulled by all different companies for all different means to lead us to, you know, eat more food, to lead us to gamble more, to lead us to buy more. I don't necessarily blame the corporations. I mean, their job is to sell stuff. So it really becomes up to us to figure out, okay, how can I interrupt this loop and how can I take some agency here?
Exactly.
to help myself, because, you know, I don't see a future where all of a sudden the government is regulating all these shopping websites and regulating whether, you know, food companies can make, how delicious their food can be, and whether gambling companies can do X, Y, Z. I mean, gambling's pretty heavily regulated, but, you know, it's always going to be there. And, you know, frankly, when you think of something like, take social media, what makes videos compelling is that they're really exciting. They leverage on elements of the scarcity loop. And so in order to sort of slow people down watching, say, YouTube video after YouTube video, you would need to ask the YouTube creators to make videos that were more boring. And it's like, do we really want to do that? No. It's like, you really need to kind of figure out some simple tactics that you can use to live better in this kind of strange but amazing world we live in now.
Yeah. So as you're talking about YouTube, that made me think about, like, one of the anecdotes you give in your book is about a professor, and he's like an architect, and he was building Legos with his kid, and the way his son went about solving the problem was vastly different than how it was that he was trying to solve that problem. A, go ahead and share that story with folks, but then B, what is it? Well, yeah, let's start there. Go ahead, share that story, because I want to follow up with what you said about the YouTube content creators and potentially creating less stuff and how that's not the solution. But yeah, can you talk about specifically that Lego anecdote?
Yeah. So this guy, his name's Leidy Klotz, and he's a professor of engineering. He's probably one of the best engineers in the country. And he's playing Legos with his son, and they're making this bridge. And once they go to connect the bridge, they got the two pillars, and then they connect the span to the two pillars. They find that the bridge is wonky because they have one pillar that is taller than the other pillar. So this thing is, the span is at an angle. So, you know, Mr. Engineer goes, all right, we can solve this problem. He turns around and he starts rifling through the Lego bucket to find the, you know, the blocks he needs in order to elevate the second span. But when he turns back with the Legos, he realizes that his son has done something really interesting. And that's that he solved the problem by simply removing blocks from the taller span. Now, this solution did not occur to him in the least bit. Like, not at all. He immediately went, oh, we need to add more resources to solve this problem. So he wonders, you know, am I a weirdo? Am I unique? What he does is he gets the bridge and he makes it, again, so it's kind of wonky with the taller and shorter pillar. And he starts taking this around UVA campus. And when he has meetings with other professors and with grad students, he'll pull out the bridge and he'll say, all right, fix this. And he'll have, you know, Legos on the table. Every single person tries to solve the problem by adding more Legos, by adding more resources, even though taking away Legos is a better solution because then you have more resources, right? Mm-hmm. So he, long story short, is this leads him to study this phenomenon, set up a bunch of different experiments, and he finds that basically people are programmed to add. So when we try to solve problems, we typically throw resources at them if we can, even when subtraction is the better solution. So it's not that adding or subtracting is any better, but if we aren't even considering subtraction, like, that's not good, right? We want to have all our options on the table, and yet we tend to add. And as we get more and more resources, we tend to just pile on and pile on and pile on.
Yeah. And that kind of alludes to the scarcity to bring. So the reason I wanted you to share that is, like, as you mentioned, the YouTube creators, I guess I started to internally wrestle with, man, yes, institutions, creatives, publishers, writers, we're not necessarily going to slow down in this stuff that is created out there in the world. And so on one hand, you have creatives and you've got companies and institutions that are going to continue to produce. But on the other hand, we have just as much time in our limited days. Like, we have just as much money. It's almost like, on one hand, things are going to continue to exponentially explode in quantity, but it means that, I guess, that on an individual level, it's more important than ever for us to figure out how it is that we can say no to a lot of that stuff. Would you say that that's true?
How we can say no to
just the quantities of solutions at our fingertips, or food, or media, right? Like, information, you spend a chapter talking about that. There's so much that's at our fingertips. It seems like it's more important than ever for us to figure out how to regulate our intake.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I think one great way to do this is, so I told you about the scarcity loop. If you interrupt or change or remove any of the three parts, that tends to reduce the frequency that you will do a behavior. So I'll give you a couple examples. availability, so opportunity. If you can just take away the opportunity to do something, that will reduce the amount of times you do it. So a simple rule of saying, look, I'm only going to make purchases in person because that's a huge barrier to entry, or saying, like, I have a problem with this junk food. It's so simple, but it's like, well, don't keep it in the house.
Right?
You can change how rewarding something is. You can change the unpredictable rewards. So there's some fascinating research on cell phone use. And one of the reasons that cell phones are so interesting and compelling is the rewards through the bright screens and all the different colors you see. So when people put their phones into grayscale, that reduces how rewarding and stimulating the phone is. And people's cell phone time tends to drop by about an hour a day. In studies. And then finally, you can slow down the behavior as well. There's an app that I really love for people who spend too much time on certain apps, and it's called ClearSpace. And basically what this app does, it leans on behavioral psychology, and it inserts a pause before you want to use any app. So it goes, are you sure you want to use this app when you go to open it? And you have to go, yes. And it goes, okay, let's take a breath together. You know, and you have to take a breath for 10 seconds, and then you have to go, and then it asks you, how long do you want to use the app? Because now it's like, it realizes you're going to go off the rail. So you go, okay, I'm going to use it for 10 minutes. And that will, I mean, it's leaning on psychology that we've known works since the 40s. And it definitely reduces the frequency of app use. And so I think it's finding useful tools and tricks to get around the scarcity loop are the way to combat it, really.
To help us do the things we actually want to do over the long term, as opposed to the things we think we want to do right in the heat of the moment. Because the truth is, there's a lot of things I want to do in the heat of the moment that aren't really helping me in my bigger goals. And that is what getting sucked into 20 minutes of doom scrolling is for a lot of people at the end of the night. It's like, that's not how I expected or hoped to spend my evening. It just kind of became the default and the easy thing to do. And that's what our phones are. The data also finds that thinking about long-term consequences can help cool cravings, right?
Yep.
So thinking maybe about how doing something like that, doing something negative, going down that rabbit hole could, seeing how, wait a second, that might actually help or hurt me in my ability to achieve the thing I want to achieve 10 years down the road. How do we connect those dots? It makes me think of like Fidelity did this study back in the day about if we just looked at a picture of ourselves that was 30 years of age on it, where Matt and I look like we're grandpas instead of like, you know, geriatric millennials, how that makes an impact on how much people save and invest for their future. And it has a real, real impact. It helps people connect the dots. Are there other ways that we can kind of connect those long-term dots in our lives?
Yeah, I think it's the research on smoking is really interesting. So scientists will have smokers. Even just think about the long-term consequences of smoking, cancer, things like that. And smoking behavior tends to reduce. I mean, I think really it is a little bit of an uphill swim because we are surrounded in so many stimulating things. And I'm also, you know, not saying that no one should ever have any fun ever again. but I do think trying to insert pause and make sure you're doing behaviors consciously is really the answer. And again, it's like people really get just trapped in this scarcity loop. It's what makes people zone out to phones. It's what makes people zone out to slot machines, all these different behaviors. And understanding the mechanics of that is one of the first ways to stop it.
Exactly. Plus, you know, going in for that elementary school presentation when they brought the lungs in, suspended in formaldehyde. You saw the lungs that were the smoker's lungs and then the lungs that were not. Right, Michael?
Well, that's...
Oh, totally.
talking about smoking, it makes me... All the changes that have happened, one, to cigarette cartons, two, to where cigarettes are kept in a gas station. Think about what happens in Europe, like the way they label the cigarettes over there. And it all of those extra roadblocks, essentially, to buying cigarettes or participating in the smoking community, I think has is part of what's dramatically led to a reduction in smoking. So you can't necessarily throw it all on like one thing. Oh, it was smoking abstinence talks in elementary school or something like that.
All scared straight.
Right. Exactly. It's maybe some of that, right? But then it's all these other things too that just kind of remove smoking from consciousness and make it more of like kind of a rebrand it in like a grotesque sort of way. So yeah, that's fascinating. But all right, we've got a few more questions to get to with you, Michael, specifically about like how to use gamification maybe to push us on our path to achieve the things we want instead of having it prevent us from doing that. We'll talk about that right after this. Cachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Cachava really earns their 52,000-plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Cachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Cachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the a.m. in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Cachava. Just go to cachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com/howtomoney.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simons on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, we are back, and again, we're talking about how you can overcome your scarcity brain with Michael Easter. And Michael, like Joel mentioned before the break, gamification is really interesting because it can... I feel like we've talked about just all the bad ways that gamification is being used against us, but simultaneously, it can be a really positive thing. I mentioned my brand new Garmin watch that Joel talked me into getting, but it's got this score that I'm looking at right now. It's called VO2 Max, and it's this singular number that I'm able to look at, and man, do I want to game my watch so that I see that number grow.
That's his 99, by the way.
It's not even possible, Joel. Come on. But yeah, talk to us how gamification, how it can be so effective when it comes to our ability to change our behavior, whether for negative or for good.
Yeah, well, one thing that I'll start with, because this audience is interested in finance, is that numbers are pretty new in the grand scheme of time and space. There are actually still some tribes in the world, in the Amazon, that don't use numbers. So researchers think that humans basically evolved thinking, being able to count basically up to three. And then everything thereafter, we would use small, medium, and large designations for all different things.
Interesting.
Yeah. So numbers get invented, I think it was about 10,000 years ago. And this very much changes our behavior. and what we do, because now we can quantify things, we can be more precise, and numbers allow us to really just take a big swath of some big concept and make it simple, right? So if you think about, I'll use your VO2 max thing. Why we care about VO2 max is because it's a marker of health. It's a marker of fitness. And allowing, being able to put a number on it basically just tells you how you are doing. But really, when you look at the big picture, it's like, okay, well, why do we care about health? And how do we define health? And what is fitness to us? What do you mean, right? It's a big, complicated concept with a lot of different answers. It's really murky. So numbers just allow us to sort of understand things very quickly. And so when I think about it in terms of gamification and how it can help us, it can help people do behaviors that they want to do and easily measure their progress along the way. So with you, it's like, if you can get that, if you can do these things that are going to get that VO2 max up, that number, you can be rather sure that you've done some things that are probably going to move you away from disease. For me, it could be like, I don't know, I'm sure there's finance apps out there that are using gamification to get people to save more,
yeah,
or to invest more, or to, I mean, you guys would know better about those than I would. I think the problem is when we focus on the number only without asking, well, why do I care about this number in the first place?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So,
well, that makes me think of, like, there was a credit union in Michigan, and then there was a bank that launched something really similar. It hasn't taken off quite as much as I would have hoped. But instead of paying higher savings rates to everybody, it had like a lottery sort of aspect to it, right? So everybody gets paid, instead of 5%, maybe they get paid 2%. But then there's winners every single week where if you hit certain savings targets, you're eligible. You can win $1,000, $5,000, $10,000, stuff like that. And that actually, even though maybe less money overall is going out to the average person, because there's a gamification aspect to savings, it pushes people harder in that direction. And that's the kind of stuff that, like, it's not making companies as much money as, let's say, getting people to spend. It's not going to get funded in nearly the same way. But I love to see stuff like that on the gamification side that push people towards, like, the good habits that we want, yes, to see them express.
Yeah, totally. And I think it is, you know, when I think about it from a financial perspective, it is like, the reason you care about saving in the first place is that you don't want to end up in a position where you are more constrained, where you end up, you know, older and you're out of money and now you've got all these problems. At the same time, when I think about salary, it's like, we all want to see the salary number go up, but then the question is why, right? Because ideally it allows us to live more free or a better lifestyle. Now, at the same time, pushing the salary number up over time might actually require you to do things that make you less happy, that make, yeah, you less free, right? So that number, wanting that number to go up, can start to constrain you. The bigger question is, like, what does this number stand for overall? Like, why do we care in the first place? And unpacking that, I think everything from the number on your fitness app to the number in your bank account to your health scores to all these different ways that gamification gets used, it's realizing that you can use that number, the gamification, as a tool to incentivize better behaviors. At the same time, knowing what the bigger meaning of that better behavior is and why you're doing that in the first place, I think is important, so you don't start just chasing the number for the sake of the number and actually have the behavior backfire.
Exactly.
No, that's true. I mean, like, even with saving or investing, you can overdo it. That's something we talk about on the show here too. And so you can max out your 401k every single year for a decade and find that you've squandered relationships because you were working too hard and you were too focused on investing. And so that's possible too, right? You can have the wrong short-term view in hope of this, like, long-term supposedly good ideal, but why are we maxing out our 401k
in the first,
like,
place?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we should be, but maybe we shouldn't be. And it's different for every person.
Yeah. I mean, sort of what Mike was saying earlier, the key to so much of this is just moderation.
Yeah.
And, but, like, we are
so bad at that.
We're so bad at moderation when it comes to any of the different things that we allow into our lives or the different things that we pursue. But truly, that is the answer. And, man, it's so powerful what you said about the numbers too, is that it oversimplifies things. Because, like, I think we crave simplification. We crave the ability to look at a number on a watch and be like, oh, haven't hit my steps, or, oh, my VO2 max dropped a point. I got to get out there, get do some more running. But there is a whole lot of information or quality, perhaps, that gets lost in that translation. Like, one of the examples you gave in your book, you talk about one of the wine magazines or wine websites, but how it used to be where when they would try to rate wines, folks would use big flowery language. But what that meant was that it was inaccessible to a whole lot of folks because it was so snobbish. But then somebody came along and they attached a number to wines. Can you talk about that and how that sort of changed that industry?
Yeah, so you get this guy, Robert Parker, and he started Wine Advocate magazine.
Wine Advocate, that's right.
Yeah, and so what he did is he would start giving wines a score from, I think, 50 to 100. Now, when he did that, it simplified this really complex thing, which is trying to understand whether a wine is good or bad, right?
Like, sure.
You could read a whole paragraph on 20 different wines, or you could just look at the number and go, oh, well, that one got a 95 and this one got a 94. Therefore, that one is better. The 95 is clearly better. And so people really latch on to this rating system. Now, the issue is that Parker was rating the wines. And so he's obviously has his own preferences and tastes. And what tends to happen is that when he gives a wine a score of 90 or above, it tends to fly off the shelves, while wines that are, say, in the 80s or in the 70s, they don't sell quite as well. So vintners, winemakers, they notice this and they go, oh, we need to start making wines that this guy will like. We need wines that are a 90 plus by Wine Advocate. So that's what they start doing. And it changes this winemaking tradition that had been going on for thousands and thousands of years, all because this guy's taste and his ability to put a number on things. Now, if you don't have the same taste as this guy, though,
exactly,
this information is useless to you.
Yep.
And like the wines that you used to like from the winemaker, now it's changed because they're trying to have it be, you know, good in this guy's eyes. Now, the other problem, too, is that people usually eat food when they drink wine. But if you're trying to rate something objectively, you can't have food with it. So now this has changed the whole freaking purpose of the wine and the winemaking. But it's not, you know, the important point is that it is not just in wine. You also see this in basically the scoring or rating of anything from movies to books to music to, you know, Yelp reviews to all these different things. So numbers really allow us to simplify really complex data. That is good for speed, but we leave out a lot of nuance, we leave out a lot of accuracy, and we leave out a lot of individual variation.
Yeah. All right, Michael, you say scarcity is the mother of invention, ideas, and breaking new ground. So, I don't know, give me your final thoughts on scarcity and how it impacts all of us on a day-to-day level when it comes to our money and when it comes to just generally our happiness in life.
Yeah, there's a really interesting study that I cite in the book, and it basically took two groups, and it gave them a series of problems to solve using different resources. And for one group, they gave them effectively unlimited resources to solve the problem. And so that's what the people did. They just, you know, they threw resources at it, they threw money at the problem, and they did solve it. Now, the other group, they had very limited resources. They had to sort of figure it out and MacGyver fix the problem. Now, they also solved the problem too, except that the way that they solved it used fewer resources. Their fixes for the problem were also deemed more creative, more intuitive. And so I think that what happens when we face scarce resources is, like I mentioned with that other study from the Lego study, our tendency is to just try and throw money at it, throw resources at it, right? But if we just put some constraints on ourselves and go, okay, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to pretend that I have no resources to solve this problem, how would I try and solve it without any resources? I think that, one, you can not only solve it, but two, your problem will often be much better than you might have expected. And that saves you money over the long term when you think about the problems that people face in their daily life and the financial means that those require.
I love it. Yeah, that might be the best argument for less is more.
Yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for talking with us. Where is it folks can learn more about you, your book, and what you're up to?
Yeah, go on my website, Easter Michael. I have a newsletter and it's got a big archive with a lot of stuff like how you can learn more about that scarcity loop I talked to and how it applies to finances, how it applies to all these different things. So yeah, check out my website. You can sign up for the newsletter there and get the archive. And yeah, that's probably the best place to find me.
Right on. Awesome. We'll link to all that stuff in our show notes as well. Michael, thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was great to talk.
Nice. All right, man. That was a great conversation. Do you think we've had any conversation that was any less about money than the conversation we just had with Michael?
More about human behavior.
But simultaneously, it just underpins how it is that we handle money. Just like, you know, the mindset when it comes to developing positive, good habits that are going to lead us to be able to ultimately, hopefully, have more money on hand to kind of live the life that we want to live. But
I thought about asking Michael at the very top, like, if he knew how much people were able to put into a 401k or a Roth IRA or something this year. I assume he didn't, because it's just not his thing, you know, which just to prove a point that, like, we had Michael on for other reasons. He's, like, brilliant, vastly knowledgeable on all of these other things that impact our money,
yes,
but indirectly, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, that being said, what was your big takeaway? Are you going to try to channel it in a personal finance direction?
Okay,
or no?
There's two different ways I feel like I go here, but I'm going to say this. When he said everyone sucks at moderation, and I think he's right. Like, I think it's really, really hard to be a moderate in this day and age. I mean, think about everything in our political landscape points to polarization, hard left or hard right, right? And or really, if we're going to try to accomplish anything, it being sort of middle of the road seems like the craziest choice to make. But we think for the most
radical
part,
middle.
Most of the time, it's actually a good path to trot.
Yeah.
And when it comes to what your goals are, well, define your goals based on maybe more moderation. Like, do you want to get fit? Cool. Do you need or want to be Arnold Schwarzenegger level fit? Probably not. Like, I certainly don't. But like, what are your money goals? Amassing millions and millions and millions? That might not be it either. You probably don't want to, just like us. You don't want to be the next Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. For many reasons, but and that means.
Oh, please, I know you want a rocket ship to blast off into space.
That's a good point. I do, but not having those extreme goals is actually, I think, going to lead to a happier life. And sometimes, when it comes to the consumption side of things too, figure out what does it look like to maybe indulge in some of these things. Know that they exist. Know that these mechanisms are pulling at me, but that I also don't have to go whole hog.
Mm-hmm.
I can be a moderate Amazon user, right? Stuff like that. Like, I can moderately use my phone without going overboard. It's about pulling back in the ways that make sense for us, so that we can live a life that more fully reflects who we want to be.
Dude, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. So my big takeaway kind of dovetails with that a little bit. But so he was talking about numbers and how they're relatively new, and how numbers in and of themselves are a gamification tactic on whatever it is that you're measuring. Like, it doesn't matter what it is, whether you're measuring how fast you can run, grades. That's something that makes me think of a recent piece I was reading in the Times recently about how SAT scores and college. College success rates there. Or with here on the show, what we talk about, personal finance, net worth, man, what a number that is incredibly easy to put your finger on.
Mm-hmm.
And we like it because it's simple, it's straightforward, and it's easy to compare too, right? Not only to yourself, but man, how easy is it to compare to others? I guess you don't always know what somebody else's net worth, but the perceived net worth. And certainly when it comes to consumption, you know, oh, I don't know how much that truck costs. Well, my truck costs this much.
But that means their net worth went down.
Exactly. So it's kind of contrary there. But when it comes to those who are seeking after, specifically FIRE, right, like financial independence, retiring early, I think there can be an obsession with it because you're trying to hit your number. Like, that's the term that those folks oftentimes will use. And yes, it's more efficient to figure out where you are on your journey. Yes, it is easier. But man, are you missing out on so much of life that fits in between those numbers, that fits in between those monthly check-ins to your net worth, and figuring out, sort of like what you said, what it is you want your life to look like is so important more than ever, because we have so many resources at our disposal that we can choose to chase after.
Yeah.
But are you chasing after the things that you want to chase after in this world, in this day and age, I think is a more important question than ever before.
Well, and choosing not to decide is deciding to choose, or whatever, you know what I'm saying.
You're choosing by default.
Exactly. Somebody else is going to choose for you, and specifically, mm-hmm. it's going to be advertisers. It's going to be the phone that's in your hand. It's going to be whoever's closest by you. Like, those are going to be the things that impact you the most when it comes to what you end up actually doing, as opposed to you proactively making that decision. So,
couldn't agree more, man.
Yeah. Although, slightly off topic from personal finance. Felt like, especially at the beginning of the year, given how great Michael's book is, it was well worth having.
Well, that's what's so great too about his book is, like, there aren't like three clear steps that you need to leave this conversation or leave even reading his book knowing that these are the three things that you need to address. And so we most definitely recommend for everyone out there to seriously read his book, yes, cover to cover, because the examples that he gives, it just sheds light on humanity, yeah, essentially, as opposed to, I don't know, what might feel more like a cheap takeaway. But it makes me want to recommend for folks to check out the How to Money money mission statement, because that's what we're talking about here, yeah, is you asking yourself some of these larger questions. It's less the immediate tactics and strategies and of how you're going to achieve those things, but from a very high level, deciding for yourself which direction you want your life, yep, to be going in.
Those two things actually would pair really well together, this book and the money mission statement. Yeah. And the money mission statement's free. We'll link to it in the show notes. Yep. And by the way, Michael's just a great writer. So that's another reason. If you, yes, want to read, yeah, a book written by someone
so good
who's curious and that comes across in every inch of the text, then this book is for you. All right, Matt, let's get back to the beer. This one is called Nelson Double IPA by Evergreen Brewing. Listener Rihanna, this is our last beer from her. Big thanks to Rihanna for donating beers to the show. Matt, what were your thoughts on this beer?
My thoughts are that, so this is a single hop series, and it's called Nelson because it's Nelson hops.
Yep.
And all I know now is that I love Nelson hops.
Same.
Because, oh my gosh, the flavor, it's got like all the hop flavors that I'm looking for.
Uh-huh. In one hop.
Well, yes, yeah, it's phenomenal.
I completely agree.
It's so good. Not too sweet, not too earthy, not too piney. Man.
It's not too one note. Some of the other hops,
yeah,
you're like, oh, clearly this is piney. Oh, clearly this is citrusy. And this one, it runs the gamut with one hop, but it really highlights the things I love about hops the most. So for Nelson hops always stick out as a fave, and this beer does that hop justice.
Yeah, I feel like I'm slowly expanding my knowledge, and you would think, with you and me being such beer nerds,
that
we would have a better handle as to some of the different flavor character profiles of some of the different hops, but I feel like I can add another one to my mental checklist.
There you go.
Nelson, they got it going on.
Nice.
Yeah,
I love it. All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode, folks. Can't wait to see you back here on Friday for a Friday flight. And by the way, if you want links to some of the stuff we mentioned, including Michael's book and newsletter, you can find those up on our website at howtomoney.com.
That's right, buddy. So that's going to be it for this one. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out. Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.